Hi, this is Bob Enyart with Real Science Radio. Today is Friday the 13th. If you are interested in how that superstition began, please check out our website, rsr.org/13. Yes, that's just the number 1313, rsr.org/13. We begin with the work of Dr. Jonathan Sarfati at Creation Ministries International, and then we add our own Real Science Radio insights. You just might love it. That's rsr.org/13.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune into Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart, and I'm very excited.
Well, I'm excited too, Bob, and I'm Fred Williams.
Hey, Fred, how you doing?
Creation speaker and software engineer.
So I'm excited about the progress against muscular dystrophy. This is huge, using gene editing software. But Fred, this could have happened maybe 15 years ago.
Oh, at least. Yeah, there's a technology, they call it CRISPR. And it's a gene editing mechanism that they've come up with by studying the bacteria genome. And
yes.
So this bacteria has this immune system mechanism. It recognizes invading viruses. It's really cool. It goes in and it snips pieces of that virus.
It cuts it up with a molecular scissors.
It does. And
yes.
It inserts it in its DNA and it becomes like a marker.
It remembers the signature of the virus that attacks it.
Yeah.
And so then it uses that signature as a way to identify it in the future. And when it does, it takes its molecular scissors and chops the stuff up.
It's
and
amazing.
It could also insert new DNA to where it's chopping or extracting other segments of DNA. So, Fred, this is now being used as a genetic editing tool to fix genetic disease. For example, muscular dystrophy so far in laboratory mice, and they're fixing them. They're fixing the mutation on the gene on the X chromosome that gives you the most popular form of muscular dystrophy, the Duchenne muscular dystrophy.
That's right. And they say that the mice that have the muscular dystrophy, it's pretty much what humans have. So
yeah.
They're very confident
that
this will work.
The cause is the same, right?
Yes.
And so muscular dystrophy, it atrophies the muscles, the skeletal muscles, even your heart, which is a muscle. It's devastating.
Yeah, you just get weaker slowly over time.
About 20,000 boys are born with this disease every year around the world, and they die often at age 16. That's a pretty typical life expectancy. It's passed down on your X chromosome, which means when a boy gets it, he only has one X chromosome, and so he inherits it from his mother. Because it's XY, you get your Y chromosome from your father.
Mm-hmm.
But girls, they get two X chromosomes, one from mom, one from dad. And so even if they inherit the muscular dystrophy mutation, they still will have their other chromosome, hopefully, will be healthy. And so then half of their cells or so will make the protein that you need in order to have healthy muscles.
Yeah. And you know what's frustrating and really tragic about this is, and as we see from the Independent reported on this in November 2013.
Yeah, this is a London news outlet, the Independent.
Yeah. So Japanese researchers discovered this CRISPR and bacteria back in 1987. But the scientists. In 1987.
That's a long time ago.
Yeah, 30 years ago.
And for the longest time, like about two decades.
Yeah.
They ignored it. Why would they ignore this, which turns out to be a major revolution now in the treatment of genetic disease?
So for almost 20 years, this was ignored, as reported in The Independent, because scientists mostly dismissed it as junk DNA.
Junk DNA.
How long have we heard
junk DNA?
Yeah, that repeat sequences in the DNA, or that's just junk.
Yeah,
that doesn't do anything.
It's non-functional. So they were so naive. Remember that I had on this program many years ago a famous anti-creationist, Dr. Eugenie Scott, PhD.
Yep.
She loves to attack creationists. And I kept asking her, Eugenie, give me your best two or three examples of evidence that any higher level function has ever evolved. Just your best one, two, or three.
Could you begin, Eugenie, by letting us know what you believe are the three best evidences that show that new features have evolved in higher species?
I don't really know what you mean by the question, Bob. When we were talking about evidence for evolution versus evidence for special creation, and I wanted to ask you about something called pseudogenes, which are sections of genetic material that don't have any function. If they were turned on, they would just put out gibberish because they don't code for any real proteins or any enzymes or anything like that. Why is it that you find pseudogenes that have exactly the same sequence of amino acid bases in closely related forms, but you don't find them in distantly related forms?
Eugenie, it took scientists a century to figure out what some of the higher structures in the human anatomy do. What do they do? Like the pituitary gland. It's somewhat conceited of us to say we fully understand genetics and we know that this material has no function.
If we are clever enough to be able to sequence a protein so that we know the exact order of amino acids and we know exactly what that protein does, that protein is not doing something else. It's not our ignorance. It's the lack of willingness to admit that this is a non-functioning protein.
Do you think, on the subject of genetics and what different genes and bits of information code for and what they do not code for, do you think we have most of that knowledge, or do you think we are still to gain most of the knowledge of understanding how genetics works?
There's a lot of knowledge that we still are learning about all the time,
right,
but that's irrelevant.
Know, Eugenie,
that's irrelevant to pseudogenes.
Eugenie, maybe we could set up a ground rule. For every question of yours that I answer, maybe you'd answer one of mine.
Still trying to answer your first one.
Eugenie, do you think we have most of the knowledge that there is to possess about genetics, or do you think we're mostly still in the dark with the majority of the knowledge still to come?
Oh, I think we're over the hump.
Oh, you think
I think there's
more,
plenty more to
Eugenie?
Learn, but we got the basics.
Okay, Eugenie, this is what I want to do. I want to date this 1998, May 5th. Eugenie Scott, a degreed scientist, has said. I'll state what my position is. Most of our learning on genetics is yet to come. And we are getting ahead of ourselves when we state that this part of this DNA chain is useless, it's meaningless. I'm saying that there is much to come that we don't know about yet, and in the future we'll find out all kinds of things about DNA that we've never known before. And so one of your big arguments you're presenting to the audience is that there's parts of the DNA chain that we don't know. You know,
no, I'm not talking about silent regions that we don't know the function of. I agree with you completely. There's a lot to be learned.
Even the
I'm
parts that we know the functions, we know some of the functions. Genes have all kinds of influences on different parts of the body that we're just learning about. Isn't that true?
Right, but if you've got 100 segments...
Hold on.
What she could come up with was junk DNA.
Yeah, and she hemmed and hawed for quite a while. You kind of really drag that one
out
of her.
Maybe a half hour into the one-hour broadcast.
Yeah.
So finally she says junk DNA, and I ask her, Eugenie, don't you think we're just beginning to understand genetics so that it's too early to say that all this non-coding DNA is junk, that it has no function? She said, oh, no, we know, we affirmatively know that it has no function.
Yeah.
That's a world-famous anti-creationist evolutionist.
And that was somewhere into this dark period of 20 years where they're ignoring this really amazing discovery, CRISPR. Finally now, here the last decade, we're finally researching this and using it as a tool.
Yes.
To help repair DNA. Some company was just reported in the news just here this week. They got a bunch of funding, like $78 million, and they're going to use this technology, this CRISPR technology, to work with immunology that we've reported
targeted
on the show.
Targeted antibodies. Of course, it fits like hand in glove.
Absolutely.
Because with targeted antibodies, you're typically wanting to make molecular changes the way a bacteria would want to have an antiviral defense system. And so, Fred, this is really so astounding. it is like, and some of the science reporting has pointed out, it's like doing a search in a word processor, like Microsoft Word or on your browser. You know, you do Control F, then you type
in
a string.
A search word.
So the string in CRISPR is a sequence of DNA or RNA. And then it finds that sequence, it latches onto it, and then the snipping and the inserting.
Yeah.
Which is just astounding. And so that means we take this CRISPR-Cas9. The Cas9 is an enzyme that does the snipping.
Mm-hmm.
And we figure out, okay, which part of the gene, the DNA instructions that code for the protein you need for your muscles, which part of it is mutated? Okay, we found that. Now we use CRISPR and we modify it so it finds that target string, like a search function in a word processor. It finds it, latches on, and then cuts it out, replaces it, fixes it, and snip, snap, you're good as new.
Yeah.
And so, Fred, then your cells begin to produce the correct proteins, and you could do this when a child is young. You could do it in the womb. You could do it to an adult.
Yeah, that's right. I find it real interesting how the repeat sequence, and they use a word in this CRISPR, one of the words in it, it's a palindromic. And that's that whole thing where it repeats the opposite direction, how like race car, if you write race car out and then you read race car the other direction,
backwards.
It says backwards, it says race car.
It says race car.
So,
in fact, the first sentence ever uttered was a palindrome.
Oh, was it?
Madam, I'm Adam. Madam, I'm
Madam,
Adam. Same backwards and forwards.
So if you read that backwards and forwards,
yeah.
that's pretty
Madam,
good.
I'm
huh.
Adam.
Yeah.
So CRISPR stands for clustered, regularly interspaced, short palindromic repeats. So they look at this stuff, Fred, and they think, well, this is just crazy. This is not a protein. They thought for decades, if it doesn't make a protein, it's junk.
Yeah.
That is so absurd. And when we talk about functional information in DNA, think about a book. A book has information in it. Well, what if somebody said, well, look at the spine. The spine doesn't have any information in it. Let's cut off all spines of all books because they're a waste of material because they have no information.
Yeah.
And pretty soon all your information is all scattered. The pages get all mixed up. The parts of DNA that don't have protein information, instructions for building them, easily have incredible functions.
Oh, yeah. They have other information like regulatory functions.
Oh. You know,
how much of this gene am I going to make? It's like a knob.
Regulating.
Up and down the heat. It controls how much of a certain thing.
Yes, feedback mechanisms.
Exactly.
And not only regulatory mechanisms for your daily maintenance of your life, but also developmental regulatory functions in the DNA, which for the human is off the charts as compared to the regulatory functions of other creatures.
And what's so astounding too, Bob reported on this before, we can read the thing backwards and get a totally different function.
DNA.
Wow. It's just so amazing.
Parts of the DNA you read forward and backward and you get different functions.
Yeah.
That's astounding. So we have often described evolution, the theory of evolution, as a science stopper because it is. In this case, it was a science stopper in finding the most significant development in medical treatment in centuries. This CRISPR technology held it back, what, about 19 years worth of delay.
Who knows how many people have passed that could have gotten this treatment.
Right, because it's not only muscular dystrophy, and still, we got to repeat, they're now fixing this muscular dystrophy mutation in mice, laboratory mice, but it's the same problem in human beings.
Yep.
And CRISPR will work in human beings. So we'll see how long it takes now to turn this into a treatment. And the FDA, I think, is going to greenlight these kinds of treatments.
Yeah.
Oh, and there's something else, Fred. Next to the grief of all the extra lives lost because of this evolutionary science stopper of Darwinism, next to that, this is a relatively minor disappointment, but it's sad nonetheless that Jerry Lewis didn't live to see this development.
Yep.
If the Darwinists hadn't caused the 20-year delay by their science-stopping junk DNA blinders, he would have seen this amazing ability to fix this muscular dystrophy mutation. And in fact, the Muscular Dystrophy Association did provide some of the funding to identify this mutation in this particular gene on the X chromosome.
And, you know, maybe for a future show, we talk about promising results they're getting now with CRISPR cutting into RNA that's helping with things like Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS, which is a terrible disease. It's like muscular dystrophy. And they're making great progress there by
Huntington's.
Yeah, Huntington's disease.
Fred, that's our Darwinism Science Stopper segment.
Yeah.
Now, one of our most popular pages on rsr.org, our website, is our list of not so old things. It's so
fun. Or not so slow things.
Or not so slow things. So we should add this new discovery to our list of not so old and not so slow things, because this has to do with the speed with which a supervolcano could be charged up and blow. Fred, you know, they always say things take millions of years.
Oh,
that's,
of course.
That's the
default. That's their religion.
Everything takes millions of years. Or it takes tens of thousands of years, many millennia. Well, they did research at Yellowstone and the supervolcano that's under most of the park there. When we went there this summer, Cheryl and I brought our sons. We were thinking about this because there were eruptions going like crazy. And they were minor, but there were hundreds of them. It turns out that when they thought, well, it takes thousands of years to trigger an eruption of a supervolcano, now they're saying, well, we had to rethink that because now we've got data.
Yeah, they actually have evidence. And it turns out it only takes decades for this magma to build up before an eruption.
Decades. And what they've done at Yellowstone, at Yellowstone's Lava Creek Tuff, which is a fossilized ash deposit from its super eruption, they've also done this elsewhere. And they found out when they analyze the crystals in the volcanic material, they provide a record of changes in temperature, pressure, water content beneath the volcano. And of course, geologists have to interpret all those things.
Mm-hmm.
But they see it much like a set of tree rings. And we know they're not very good at tree rings because trees will form multiple rings per year. And they know that, but they ignore that.
Yeah.
But they're saying, we now see that it only requires decades to be recharged, not the millions of years that they had suggested for quite some time. And then 2 years ago in the journal Geology, there was a paper that said, whoa, heads up, this might only take 500 years. And now, wow, now they recognize it's only decades. And probably it's a lot faster than that for a supervolcano to be charged before it blows. So that's really interesting. Because, Fred, one of our predictions to the former president of one of the U.S. geological societies at a debate downtown Denver on the age of the Earth was that earthquakes are far more likely than our old Earth geologists assume. Far more likely. And since that debate, about 800,000 people have been killed by earthquakes.
Wow.
Since that debate.
Wow.
When John Nickel asked me, the former president of this society, asked, mm-hmm. Well, Bob, do you think we should give greater intensity warnings to governments as geologists? I said, of course you should, because the Earth isn't billions of years old. It's still settling down from a worldwide catastrophic event of the global flood just thousands of years ago.
Well, you know, Bob, we become so, I don't know, we read this stuff from the evolutionist scientist journals. There's a word in here that we missed. We didn't underline it. It fits perfectly with our shocked evolutionist shows.
Yeah.
I think, again, we're so used to just reading this stuff. But look what it says here. I'm surprised we missed this earlier. It's shocking how little time is required to take a volcanic system from being quiet and sitting there to the edge of an eruption, said the evolutionist scientist.
Right.
Shocking.
It's
is shocking a scientific term?
Well, it's shocking when it challenges the fundamental assumptions of your scientific theories.
Yep.
That's when it's shocking. Not when it tweaks it, but when it really challenges the fundamentals. And so everything on the Earth is not so old, and processes are not so slow. Things that we're told take millions of years, like the island off the coast of Iceland, Surtsey, the chief geologist of Iceland says, wow, this stuff is supposed to take millions of years, but it's happening every 2 or 3 months.
Yeah.
So many examples.
And we can add this to our list of not so old things.
Yeah.
I bet it's already there.
Somebody could go look, just rsr.org/list.
And it's one of our most popular pages on the website.
It is. And that's because it's so much fun.
Yeah.
What a fun page. RSR's list of not so old things. Okay, so since we've been in Yellowstone, Fred, why don't we air the audio of our new Real Science Radio YouTube video on the petrified trees there, because there was an exhibit for decades, and it said that the trees were standing where they once grew. Not true. How did we know, as creationists, and the atheists too, but how did we know that the trees did not grow there?
Well, first of all, where is their root system?
Yeah.
Second of all, Mount St. Helens gave us a petri dish of how this whole thing can happen.
Yes, right. A catastrophic event knocks down thousands, hundreds of thousands of trees. The trees float in water. They get waterlogged. They sink vertically. And then they settle down in sediments that are being deposited at the bottom of whatever floodwaters there
are.
So this video, now we'll embed it in today's show summary, because some of the images, you just have to see them. And you have to see the Yellowstone exhibit that had been there that now is gone because creationists lobbied the National Park Service to get rid of it because their exhibit was false. And so that was a bit of a success.
Yeah, and you knew the park ranger.
Small that was success. Yeah, Cheryl and I went to his home, Mark Tanaka Sanders on Maui. You know, it's rough, but some people got to go to Hawaii for ministry purposes. And we had dinner with him and his wife, and we showed them the Mount St. Helens video. It was very persuasive. And so Mark said, okay, I'm going to work with my peer over at Yellowstone, the National Park Ranger there, and we got to get that sign removed.
That is so cool.
Okay, so Fred, hiking around Yellowstone, you get a little bit out of breath. And the wind is blowing on our cell phone video camera that we were using to take this very impromptu video. But when we splice it in with all the images and the drawings of geologists of the trees and all the layers and show that these trees have no root systems, it becomes this astounding mini lesson that you cannot trust the National Park Service whenever they give a timeline that contradicts the Bible. So let's hear the audio of our newest Real Science Radio YouTube video.
We're at Petrified Tree in Yellowstone National Park. Hi, my name is Bob Enyart with Real Science Radio. A couple decades ago, there was an exhibit here that said that this and other petrified trees had grown in situ in this location on various strata, and it happened dozens of times over. Well, 1980, when Mount St. Helens blew, then a geologist, Dr. Stephen Austin, doing research there on Spirit Lake, found that trees that were destroyed in a catastrophe were floating on the lake, and as they got waterlogged, they would sink vertically. They were upright floaters, and when they hit the bottom of the lake, as sediments continued to pour in and fill up the lake, other trees came down at different layers. And so he realized that that was the model that likely produced the trees here petrified in Yellowstone.
Thanks, Bob, yes, for playing a role in getting that sign removed. So you can find that by going to rsr.org. Our current show will be on the page at rsr.org.
And that video will be embedded right there.
Yeah. Or go to YouTube and search for Real Science Radio and become a subscriber. You've got a lot of good stuff up there, Bob.
That would be so helpful. Yeah. We're over 300,000 views now. So,
wow.
Real Science Radio, Bob Enyart Live, airs on a single radio station, not on hundreds. We wish, but it doesn't. However, this is the most powerful Christian radio station in the country, 50,000 watts, AM 670, KLTT. So, we started our YouTube channel, just recently began to put effort into it, and we're thrilled. You know, it's approaching a third of a million views.
Yeah, that's really good. And you got some of your Hydroplate video on there, lots of good stuff.
So fun.
So, Bob, how about this latest piece in the news about Neanderthal inbreeding?
It turns out a study in the journal Science, second most prestigious science journal in the world, they found that Neanderthals had been inbreeding. And, Fred, that is so interesting because it matches, of course, the historical account in Genesis, Exodus, and Leviticus. But they found that as Neanderthals bred with other ethnic groups, you know, they were humans.
Yeah.
They were people like us. But as they interbred, as they merged into other ethnic groups, and those other ethnic groups, we see that they did not continue the inbreeding.
Yeah.
So in human history,
we see that in the Bible, right?
Yeah, the Bible, because God made Adam and Eve.
Yeah.
They had kids, and their kids reproduced. Cain married his sister. That's how human families began, and it continued all the way through until Abraham married his sister, Sarah.
Well, yeah.
She was his half-sister.
Where did Cain's wife come from? He married a sister.
He married
There's
his
sister.
There's
nothing wrong at that time genetically
right.
or morally
right.
to marry your sister. And the Bible said that Adam and Eve had many offspring. They had many kids.
Yes. And so sins are the things that lead toward death.
Yep.
Sin are the things that contradict the nature of God, God's goodness, God's holiness. And so when God created Adam and Eve, he made them to reproduce and their children to reproduce.
And they were perfect.
And that was
fine. Genetically perfect.
In fact, if people want to read more about this, they could go to our website, rsr.org/incest, to find that it wasn't until the time of Moses when God prohibited the marriage between close relatives. So up until then, it was fine.
Yeah.
It was healthy. It led toward life. But after that, it would lead toward death.
Yeah. So over time, over generations, the genetic load builds up. And it came to a point where, okay, it's going to start being harmful
yes.
to have close relations like it is today.
With degenerative disease.
Yeah.
And just like we just described, if you're marrying a close relative and you both have a muscular dystrophy mutation, and you have a daughter, well, then she's going to have the bad mutation on both of her X chromosomes. So the health of the genome is maintained in a fallen world when people marry those whom they are not closely related to. What's interesting is that this latest study does reinforce this, as we've seen 1,000 times over, that the outline of history in the Bible is reinforced by a mountain of evidence around the world.
Yeah, time and time again.
Yes. Then there's another one, Fred, on dinosaur biological material. This time it's in dinosaur eggs. This is the second dinosaur egg biological paper published. And this one is fun.
Yeah. Paleontologists wanted to find out what the color of the eggs were.
The eggshells?
Yeah.
That is a fun thing, right?
Yeah.
Dinosaurs lay
eggs. So what
eggs.
Did they do? They went out and they got themselves a biochemist, a pharmaceutical chemist, and biological scientists.
Wait, why would they do that? These are just stones.
Yeah, these are fossils.
Dinosaur
yeah,
fossils
millions of years old.
They're turned to stone. They might as well just get geologists and paleontologists.
Yeah, and do what they've done before. It's just guess and draw pictures and tell and act like it's real science.
Yeah, so instead, they actually crack open the eggshell, and they're looking for original biological material, and lo and behold, they find it.
Yeah, they sure do.
Yes.
And I chuckle and think back when they first discovered soft tissue in dinosaurs and biological material, and how a lot of these scientists were saying, I don't believe it. And I remember Mary Schweitzer reported in Discover, she quoted one guy as saying, she asked him, what would convince you that this is original?
What kind of scientific data would convince you?
Yeah, what kind of scientific data would convince you that this is original biological material? And he said, none.
Nothing.
And I wonder if this guy's still in the none crowd.
Yeah, right. Could be.
Yep.
Fred, that's a fun one because we predicted that they'll find original biological material in dinosaur fossils, not rarely as they were claiming, but pretty much whenever they go look for it. You go look for it, you're not going to be disappointed. Our last segment, it's another WWB discovery.
WWB.
Working for Walt Brown.
Scientists who work for Walt Brown.
Yeah.
What did they discover for Walt this time?
Well, I love it. They discovered water on Mars for the 1,000th time.
Yeah.
I mean, they discovered that about 1,000 times over. But this is different. They found water ice at the Martian equator, and that freaks them out. Because if it's at the equator, it's not hidden from the direct rays of the sun like if it's at the poles.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not always at the base of a crater. This is just across the equator, tons of water. And how could it have been there for billions of years? So this is more evidence of recent activity in the solar system. And because of Walt Brown's hydroplate theory, we know how the water got there. It was the eruption of
the fountains of the great deep.
Love it.
Not the magma of the great deep.
No, that's true. There are a lot of creationists who haven't seen the validity of Walt Brown's hydroplate theory. And so you ask them, where did the water come from? And they say, well, the magma erupted from the great deep. The magma.
Yeah.
It's not the fountains of magma.
Yeah.
No, the great deep was water. And the fountains that erupted were water. They were not magma. It wasn't lava.
I could almost guarantee you, if you took 1,000 people and had them read that passage in the Bible, without any outside influence, they're not going to come out and say, hey, they're talking about magma, aren't they?
No, this is...
It's water.
This stuff's hitting the surface. It's all lava. Noah's Ark was designed to float on lava. Yeah. No. So, and they say, the other creationists, they say when all the magma came up, it forced the ocean waters to rise. And so the oceans sloshed up onto the continents. And that's what flooded the earth. That's just not the biblical account. And it's not the scientific evidence.
That's right. It doesn't fit either.
Right. And it doesn't explain why all this water is in comets and asteroids and on Mars. It's so much fun when you understand.
On the space station.
On the space station.
Yeah, remember that? They even found sea plankton on the space station.
Oh, yeah. That's a good point. That doesn't come from magma.
That's right.
I don't think.
If they would have found lava on the space station, okay. Bob, we'd have to start reconsidering WWB.
Yeah. But all scientists work for Walt Brown, and water ice at the Martian equator is another example of a discovery that's inexplicable apart from the hydroplate theory on the global flood. So thank you, Fred Williams.
Thanks,
so
Bob.
Much fun. I appreciate it. Hey, our telethon, we took in $25,900, almost $26,000. Our goal was $30,000. We're still hoping to find an underwriter who can help us put our full-length global flood video on YouTube for all to see. Until next week, this is Bob Enyart and Fred Williams for Real Science Radio. May God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork. Talking about.